It's Monday, December 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, complications arise in evacuating civilians from Aleppo.
It's a lot of moving parts. You know, we've got a fairly condensed space where we're working on the Capitol grounds.
Inauguration plans are being finalized here in Washington, but first, the real election for the next U.S. president is about to take place. And we look at some of the top country albums for 2016. It's all on today's International Edition. The UN Security Council was expected to vote Sunday on whether to send observers to the war-ravaged Syrian city of Aleppo to oversee evacuations and to help provide protection for civilians who remain. But that vote was postponed until later Monday. The Security Council will consider a French proposal that expresses alarm at the worsening humanitarian crisis and for the tens of thousands of besieged Aleppo inhabitants in need of evacuation. Western diplomats tell VOA they hold out little hope that the proposal will be approved by Russia, an ally of Syria's president, and a veto-wielding member of the council. Moscow has vetoed six resolutions on Syria since the conflict began in 2011. Evacuations were suspended from eastern Aleppo Friday by the government in Damascus as rebel groups, international organizations, and the Assad regime traded accusations about who was to blame. Russia said the operation to evacuate civilians and insurgents from eastern Aleppo was complete, but opposition leaders said thousands still want to flee and accused Iranian militias and Hezbollah of executing several men in the last convoy to leave the city. In the Jordanian capital Amman, dozens of Jordanians and Syrians gathered outside the Russian embassy Sunday to protest against Russia's role in the Syrian war. Maria Abatha was one of the many in the crowd.
We just want to say no to the injustice and to the killing of all the children and elderly people in Syria. What's happening there is beyond, it's a massacre, it's a mass murder. And we came here to say no, to protest against the injustice that's happening there.
Protesters chanted anti-Russian slogans and carried placards of children and other civilians killed in the conflict. They called upon the international community and the United Nations to put an end to the violations against the people in Aleppo. The United Nations humanitarian advisor for Syria, Jan Egelin, lashed out Sunday at al-Qaeda-aligned rebel fighters for upending a fragile evacuation deal for civilians, labeling the jihadists as reckless. Egelin warning that they're burning earlier in the day of buses that were meant to evacuate Shiites from two small neighboring Aleppo towns risked imperiling all relief efforts. Syrian state media and an independent monitoring group reported buses headed to evacuate two Shiite towns that had been besieged for months by rebel fighters were attacked and burned Sunday. The vehicles were en route to transport more than 2,000 sick and injured people from the towns in northwest Idlib province as part of a deal to resume the evacuation of eastern Aleppo. There, an estimated 40,000 civilians and rebel fighters have remained trapped in a small enclave since Friday. Time now on International Edition for us to take a look at social media. Michael Lippin is here in the studio with the trending topics, one of which is about the passing of a U.S. medical celebrity. Who are we talking about, Michael?
Hi, Jim. Well, we are talking about Dr. Henry Heimlich, who pioneered an anti-choking technique in the 1970s that has actually helped to save many lives, not just here in the U.S., but around the world ever since. It's a technique known as the Heimlich Maneuver. Heimlich himself lived a very long life, dying on Saturday at the age of 96 at a hospital in the Midwestern city of Cincinnati, Ohio.
Well, how is the social media world reacting?
Well, Heimlich is one of the top trending topics on Facebook today, and his obituary in the New York Times has been drawing lots of comments. And what's interesting about these comments is that they aren't just people paying tribute to Heimlich. These are Facebook users actually giving testimonials about when they used the Heimlich maneuver themselves. Here's one that I saw from a user named Lisa Noto Adelson. She said, "I did the maneuver on my daughter when she was 3 and choking on a piece of fruit. So glad I knew what to do. I will never forget that day. Rest in peace, Henry Heimlich."
Wow, a very amazing maneuver. This has saved so many lives. In fact, if you happen to be choking yourself and nobody's around, you can use the back of a chair and do this maneuver to yourself.
It is a life-saving technique for sure.
If you don't know about it, look it up. Well, I understand that there's another popular topic today. It's a blend of pop culture and the U.S. election. What can you tell us?
Well, Jim, it's the U.S. election. It's about the fact that the U.S. election isn't over yet.
Right.
Believe it or not, the last step in this process of confirming the president-elect is having the members of the U.S. Electoral College cast their votes based on who won the popular votes in each of the U.S. states last month. Now, that step of the U.S. electors casting their votes is scheduled for Monday here in the U.S., and many Democrats and liberal Americans are hoping that somehow some of the Republican electors can be persuaded not to pick Donald Trump, who, of course, beat Hillary Clinton in the race to win a majority of the Electoral College votes up for grabs. So Saturday Night Live, which is a popular satirical TV show here in the U.S., had some fun with this last night. One of its performers, Kate McKinnon, reprised her role as Hillary Clinton, and this time, she was knocking on the home of a supposed Republican elector and pleading with her to not vote Trump. But not by saying anything, rather, she silently used a series of cue cards, just like in that famous love scene in the movie Love Actually, which I confess I haven't watched. But the SNL skit is so funny, and you've got to go online to see what's written on those cue cards, as well as the expressions on Kate McKinnon's face. She makes her pleas, Jim.
All right, we'll definitely check that out. Thank you, Michael. You can follow him on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. I'm there at VOA Stevenson. And please follow our international edition stream at VOA_IE. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, Indonesian military plane crashes, killing all 13 aboard. South Korea leaders, supporters, and opponents clash in Seoul rallies. Philippines Duterte says bye-bye to U.S. and its aid. Families of slain Pakistani children mark second anniversary of massacre. Afghan villagers freed from Islamic State control join security forces. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website. And take the news with you if you have a smartphone. Try downloading our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. China says it will hand over an underwater U.S. drone it seized in the international waters of the South China Sea, prompting President-elect Donald Trump to say the United States should tell China to keep the device. Trump does not assume power for another month, but weighed in on the maritime incident in which Chinese naval forces seized the unmanned submersible while it was collecting unclassified scientific data on Thursday. U.S. authorities protested that the seizure was unlawful and demanded the drone's immediate return, which Chinese authorities agreed to do. Trump, in a Twitter comment on the initial seizure, declared, quote, China steals United States Navy research drone in international waters, rips it out of the water, and takes it to China in unprecedented act, unquote, later correcting the remark to call it unprecedented. He had unprecedented. After China promised to return the vehicle, he tweeted that the United States should, quote, tell China that we don't want the drone that they stole back, let them keep it. Donald Trump's tweets continue to be a big news topic, and we discuss it more with VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman.
I'm normally at the Senate, and I have had a chance to speak with the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker. His argument was that nobody on the world stage fears Barack Obama, that there is a sense that you can do anything, and Barack Obama's response at most will be a slap on the wrist, some tut-tutting in front of a podium. And he thinks that what's truly needed, even if what Donald Trump says isn't always appropriate for the moment or the political situation, that simply having someone who is slightly unpredictable and who will not let things slide and who has a bit of a mean streak, Senator Corker was arguing that that could actually be beneficial. If he thinks that the United States needs to be feared as much as it needs to be admired. We shall see.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps building up respect in that manner, if you will, for the country. And that was certainly one of Trump's main campaign themes was, the world doesn't respect us. The world doesn't understand the United States and its greatness, and it needs to be reestablished. And
I think President Obama would argue that the United States is respected for its adherence to the rule of law, mm-hmm. for its quiet diplomacy, for its promotion of peace and stability, and helping to keep the economic channels flowing, and all the things that the United States does on the world stage sort of behind the scenes. Its membership in various organizations and a lot of the work that it does on the world stage. Of course, Donald Trump is very much a proponent of a more muscular U.S. presence on the world stage. Does that mean militaristic? Does that mean constant saber rattling? Does that mean that we're always one tweet away from going to war? I don't know that anyone knows that just yet. But he is putting together a team that certainly has some seasoned members on it. Whether you're talking about his pick for Defense Secretary General Mattis and others, I suspect that the hope is that he will surround himself with seasoned people that will be able to perhaps rein in some of his more off-the-cuff instincts at different times. But again, this is something that we just don't know. I mean, I think that we're in somewhat uncharted territory to begin with, having elected a president who has never served. I don't know, maybe he was class president in fifth grade. I have no idea. But since then, he has yet to even serve as dog catcher, and now he's going to be president. This is going to be a fascinating 4 years.
Absolutely. I mean, I think of that fine line that Theodore Roosevelt used to say, walk softly and carry a big stick. At least Donald Trump has a big Twitter account at the moment. And the question is, how much will Donald Trump listen to those around him?
And how much will he sort of learn on the job? And is he open to learning on the job and sort of absorbing the various lessons that he will have to absorb in order to be an effective leader? This is going to be an interesting period in our nation's political history. It is interesting to note that so far China's reaction, looping back to the president-elect's conversation with President Tsai of Taiwan, has been fairly muted. I mean, given that this is the basis upon which China allows relationships to occur with other countries, the fact that the president-elect of the United States appears to have violated that core principle in some fashion, and the reaction from China is to say, well, we don't approve of this, and we hope that the United States will adhere to the one China policy, and we're going to take a wait-and-see approach, which is essentially what China's foreign minister said, I think is fascinating.
Fortunately for us, we have a veteran on Capitol Hill watching all of the developments as they unfold, and we're able to talk to VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman each and every week. Michael, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure.
The U.S. presidential election that counts is about to take place. Voting in the Electoral College takes place later today, and the outcome is expected to officially confirm that billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump will become the country's 45th president. Now, Americans have known since early November that Trump would take over the White House when he's inaugurated January 20th. U.S. presidential elections, however, are not determined by the national popular vote. Popular vote winner in each state normally receives all of that state's electoral college votes, which are allotted in proportion to the state's population. A total of 538 electors will cast ballots Monday in their respective state capitals. The Democratic candidate, former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, defeated Trump by nearly 2.9 million votes in the national popular vote, but Trump won where it mattered in enough of the state-by-state contests to claim an apparent 306 to 232 edge in the Electoral College. In most election years, voting in the Electoral College is little more than a formality, but that's not the case this year. Because of the close and bitterly contested race and continuing opposition to Trump's victory by many Clinton supporters, thousands of Americans have bombarded the 306 Republican electors with emails and phone calls demanding that they reject Trump. Most of the electors, however, are not bound by state law to vote for the candidate who won their state vote count, or if not, they feel that they're morally compelled to vote in the Electoral College the way that their state voted. Once all the formal presidential election has been decided, we move on to one of the hallmarks of American democracy, and that is a peaceful transition of power from an outgoing president to his successor. Years of planning guide the Herculean task of transforming the District of Columbia into a globally televised parade. Military leaders plan for this big day with a giant map at the nearby D.C. Armory, Arash Arabasadi reports.
This big map is a tiny version of Washington, D.C. It's here that officials from all over the country plan the path of the parade for America's 58th presidential inauguration.
It's a lot of moving parts. You know, we've got a fairly condensed space where we're working on the Capitol grounds and a fairly short amount of time where we have to get all of these events done and completed in basically what's a no-fail mission that day.
To practice, the armed forces roll out a 12 by 18 meter map of Washington. The map highlights the parade route and the logistical quagmire that partners military, federal, and local officials.
We're actually thrilled to be, as a military, to have the cooperative partnerships of the other federal agencies that we get to work with in the city, because we're moving a lot of people through a lot of people.
We have almost up to 7,000 to 8,000 soldiers coming from 40 states, so we have to ensure that we get them here, move them forward to their mission site, perform their mission on Inauguration Day, and get them back home within that 72-hour window.
January in Washington is typically cold, with temperatures hanging just around freezing. Another incentive for a smooth transition.
So it's kind of, you don't want to keep the military members out there longer than they have to be.
Inauguration Day is January 20th, a Friday, and Fridays are relatively quiet in Washington. But with the election of a truly unique president, plans on paper may evolve in the nation's capital. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, the D.C. Armory.
And if you're online, check out this huge map of the inaugural plans on our website at voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information. For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at VOANews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at VOANews.com.
VOANews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, it's that time of the year again. The Billboard year-end charts are out. Nikki Strong of VOA One The Hits joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to tell us about some of the top country albums of 2016.
Nikki, how are these charts compiled?
Well, for the top country albums chart, basically it's via Nielsen, which uses a sales tracking system.
Well, there are lists of the most critically acclaimed albums, and then there's Billboard's list based on sales. Have you found a major difference in these two?
Yeah, well, many albums loved by critics and fans, some that were even nominated and won awards, didn't make it to the top 25 on Billboard. Case in point, Aubrey Sellers, New City Blues, Brandi Clark, Big Day in a Small Town, Brothers Osborne, Porn Shop, Miranda Lambert, Weight of These Wings, Marco Price, Midwest Farmer's Daughter, Loretta Lynn. Full circle.
Yeah, they sound like a lot of them are women.
Yeah, a lot of them are women. I think critics and people are loving what a lot of these women artists do. It's just they're not getting the sales and marketing push that moves units.
Were there surprises in the Billboard top five?
Yes, yes. Okay, so the top five consist of Sam Hunt, Montevallo, who was the Number one album of 2015, by the way. He's number five this year. I think that's great. Number four is Carrie Underwood, Storyteller. Number three is Blake Shelton, If I'm Honest. And number two was the big surprise. Number two is Joey and Rory. Now, they're an incredibly courageous couple. They were fighting cancer. And they openly blogged their journey, and it riveted many of us in country music and beyond. It was a journey of faith, and they were totally transparent. And this year, we lost Joey Feek. But in the process, they actually recorded one final album together. And this is the album. It's called Hymns, and it really is a tribute to their faith. And the album didn't receive much airplay at all, but their story and music obviously moved tons of people, so many of us, that it translated to their ranking of number two.
Who was at the top of the list?
Ah, Chris Stapleton, Traveler. I call him country music's bearded Viking. He provided another kind of hope, hope that traditional country music could be just as successful and commercially viable as contemporary country, and that artists who do it can experience both commercial success and critical acclaim.
You can hear Nikki Strong count down the top 20 country albums of 2016, according to Billboard, this week on VOA One's Country Hits. You can also reach Nikki on Facebook and Twitter at VOA One The Hits. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
You're welcome.
And no doubt some more great year-end music will be coming your way in the coming days as we begin to wind down 2016 already. Wow, that went by fast. So did our program. You're listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com. We're on Facebook at VOA Now. And if you're so inclined, follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Nelson Lopes. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, fisheries recently released the final rule establishing the Seafood Import Monitoring Program. The program establishes the reporting and record-keeping requirements needed to prevent illegal, unreported, and unregulated, or IUU-caught and or misrepresented seafood from entering U.S. commerce, thereby providing additional protections for our national economy, global food security, and the sustainability of our shared ocean resources. The program requires that importers report information and maintain records about key data, from the point of harvest to the point of entry into U.S. commerce, for certain priority species of imported fish and fish products identified as especially vulnerable to IUU fishing and seafood fraud. Similar information for domestically harvested seafood is already reported under a number of existing requirements. Together, these requirements are the first phase of a risk-based traceability program that will eventually cover all species. As a global leader in sustainable fisheries management and seafood consumption, the U.S. has a responsibility to combat illegal practices that undermine the sustainability of our shared ocean resources, said NOAA Administrator Catherine Sullivan. We designed this program to further ensure that imported seafood is legally harvested and truthfully represented with minimal burden to our partners. The U.S. will use the existing international trade data system to collect seafood catch and landing documentation for the priority seafood species. This data system is the U.S. government's data portal for all imports and exports. This rule is a critical step forward in combating IUU and seafood fraud. It sends an important message to the international seafood community that if you are open and transparent about the seafood you catch and sell across the supply chain, then the U.S. markets are open for your business, said Catherine Novelli, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment. The rule will build on similar global efforts and will provide confidence to our consumers in the seafood they eat, while also leveling the playing field for honest fishers across the globe who play by the rules.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.